mine eyes have seen injustice in every city, town, and state. Your jails are filled with black men, and your streets are filled.
And welcome to this Monday edition, special Labor Day edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. For those of you joined in last week, you'll know that I'm no longer guest host, but hosting this spot on a regular basis, and it's a real privilege to be here talking about social justice issues of all kinds, and this week's show is no exception. In just a moment, we're going to be talking to Molly Stentz down on the ground in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Democratic National Convention, and then for the duration of the hour, we have a very special guest on the line. His name is Peter Dreyer, and Peter joins us from out in Los Angeles, talking about his new book, The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. Of course, part of the emphasis today will be on those folks who contributed to labor rights and the labor movement. What we're talking about, wide range of folks, and just kind of the concept of who we decide to designate as our heroes and heroines, in terms of those folks that are better known, but also those significant hundreds and thousands of folks who contribute to movements of all kind, including the Wisconsin Uprising, Occupy Wall Street. Our guest Peter Dreyer has some great observations about all of that. And this is Labor Day, though. And resonant with all these labor themes, again, Molly Stentz, WRT's news facilitator, is down in Charlotte, North Carolina, in a state that reportedly is not so kind to unions and to working people. Is that right, Molly?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you here.
Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you well. That's
okay.
I don't know if you heard my point.
Well, I'm actually on scene at the Wedgwood Baptist Church right now in Charlotte, North Carolina, where the Southern Workers' Assembly is beginning. This is a day-long convention for union members and workers across the South to coordinate and work with each other. There are a lot of people here from North Carolina as well as Virginia. As you mentioned, yes, North Carolina, where the Democratic convention is being held this week, has the lowest unionization rate in the country, hovering right around 3% of the workforce is unionized. So there are a lot of people here working to change that. You see a lot of people here from UFCW and SEIU mainly, although there's also some UE folks, United Electrical Workers, here as well.
You know, there was someone on MSNBC yesterday, a local African-American head of, I think, the Electricians Union, who was making an important point about the ties between the labor movement and the Black Civil Rights Movement. And unfortunately, of course, the connection that the South right now has been dominant and really trying to squelch the labor movement. We could hear in the background now kind of the call and response style of the meeting that you're attending. Are you feeling some of those resonances?
I apologize. I could not question.
Yeah, I was just essentially drawing connections between the Black Civil Rights Movement, the labor movement, and the fact right now the South seems to have a disproportionate role in having squelched or squelching both.
Okay, I'm walking outside. I'm sorry. They just fired up a choir that was going on behind me. I was having trouble hearing you, so I walked outside. Yeah, we're in a Baptist church. Certainly, it was actually several miles away from the convention, so we aren't in the actual convention space anymore. We're pretty far on the edge of town, but this church opened up their doors for the union members and the workers. As you mentioned, civil rights struggle, definitely very, very intertwined. John Lewis will be one of the speakers at the Democratic National Convention, and certainly with the wave of voter ID legislation that we've seen around the country, particularly in swing states and southern states, it's an issue that's on everyone's mind, the impact of voting and how hard fought those rights were, and now they're in question for many, many voters across the South and across the country.
We want to make sure to mention, of course, that you're down there reporting as part of a special series of newscasts occurring every night this week, beginning at 5 o'clock, continuing the tradition you began last week. And so you're out there getting the recordings and the interviews and trying to cover some of the things that mainstream media aren't covering. Is that job any easier in Charlotte than it was in Tampa?
Yeah, there's a new city, a new set of logistical challenges. No hurricanes here, but certainly the convention is a lot more decentralized in a way. There's a series of different events. The actual convention begins tomorrow and goes Tuesday and Wednesday. Today being Labor Day, the Democratic Party decided to hold a festival as opposed to regular proceedings. So they have closed down a main drag in town, in downtown Charlotte, and they're basically throwing an outdoor concert and a festival for the public. There's a huge focus on this convention under Obama to make the whole proceeding open to the public and transparent. A lot of the DNCC staffers this morning, they held a press conference, emphasized that they want to make this the most diverse and most transparent convention in history. And by that, they mean inviting the public in. The public will be invited to hear Obama's acceptance speech on Thursday night. They're invited to this festival downtown. They're also invited to some of the caucus meetings that are occurring today and throughout the week. You're hearing those themes over and over and over. The convention chair, Mayor Villaraigosa from Los Angeles, emphasized how many Latino and Hispanic delegates they have, a record number. They also mentioned that women comprise 50% of the delegates here at the Democratic Convention.
Are you already getting a sense of whether the folks who will be in the convention hall itself as opposed to on the podium will be a much more diverse lot than what you saw down in Tampa?
Oh, certainly. I mean, certainly the Republicans were trying to do that. You heard in their speeches a lot. They talked a lot about the promise of opportunity. You heard Condoleezza Rice. You heard several figures emphasizing how they, you know, that version of the American dream that they achieved. But I think in terms of actual numbers of delegates and actual elected officials and party figures, you're actually going to see the diversity in much greater numbers here at the Democratic Convention. There's, you know, as I mentioned, the Democrats have an affirmative action platform built into their actual delegate structure, so they consider those factors when they choose delegates and they allocate them state by state, whereas the Republicans explicitly do not. They have no mention. They make no special arrangements to ensure accessibility by different groups. That's just not part of their platform, whereas it is written into the Democratic rules. So definitely there's caucuses that for there's an LGBT caucus, Black caucus, Hispanic caucus, youth caucus, rural caucus, small business owners caucus, youth caucus, senior caucus, I'm probably Asian Pacific Islander Caucus. I'm probably leaving out a few.
All right. Hey, we really appreciate you taking time on what's a really busy day for you. It's just one more question as we get to our other guest for the hour. You know, one of the things, for better or for worse, that was clear about Tampa is Wisconsin was front stage. Its delegation was up there. And, of course, Paul Ryan and Scott Walker and others assuming a real prominence. Is there any parallel in terms of what you're going to see down in Charlotte? Are there any echoes of the Wisconsin uprising and all of the activity that was happening here?
No. I interestingly just ran into a guy wearing a We Are Wisconsin shirt that was here at the church, and we started chatting, and he had been at the Capitol occupation, and he came down here and said he'd been here for a few weeks working with union folks here. I haven't seen a whole lot of Wisconsinites other than the official delegates. Certainly you see in terms of the way that the party controls access, Wisconsin is not, it doesn't appear to be a priority for them. So the ways that they can kind of favor certain delegations shows in like the choice of hotels. So how close are your delegation's hotels to the convention center, meaning how easy is it for you to get around? Where is your delegation seated on the floor? Do you have good seats? You know, those are kind of the ways in which they show which state's supporting, and Wisconsin certainly is not in the, they don't have the prime time spot that, that we saw in Tampa. Definitely North Carolina and Virginia are the big focus here.
Yep, well, pretty exceptional year all around. But, hey, as we sign off here, if you could give maybe some credit to some of the other folks who are working with you down there. And, again, just give us a preview, about tuning in later this week. It is 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Is that right, our time?
Yes, so we are on the air every night live at 5 to 6 p.m. tonight, tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday. So we're doing an hour-long broadcast direct from the arena here in Charlotte. They actually have us in the arena where the forum is being held. So we will come to you live each night at 5 p.m. We have a great team of reporters here. We're fortunate to have a great team that we're working with, including Joe Tarr, who is a reporter for the Isthmus, as well as WORT. We have Crystalyn Bell, who's been doing multimedia work and videos. We have Norm Stockwell, who's here with us as keeping all of our technical ducks in a row. We have Steve Horn, who people might be familiar with through his work on his early work on ALEC, formerly with the Center for Media and Democracy, now with Rights for Truth Out and other blogs, doing some reporting with us. And we have Aaron Perry, our new host of the Tuesday Morning Buzz, will be anchoring the broadcast. And we ran into Jonathan Grambling from the Cat City Hughes earlier this morning. There's also a lot of other, definitely more delegates here, seemingly more press. And we are going to put together a great show. We are hoping to have on Diane Palmer from SEIU Healthcare to talk about the role she's played in the platform, and some other special guests. So stay tuned. Live at 5, we'll bring you an update from the Southern Workers Assembly, which is going on right now.
Well, we will look forward to hearing all of these reports. Again, 5 o'clock every night this week, Monday through Thursday, live from Charlotte. Molly, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. Have a good show.
All right. Have a great week. Safe travels back. Take care. And this is Public Affair Monday here on WORT-FM. And as mentioned, this is my second time as regular host. Those of you who are used to hearing Brenda Conkle at this time know that she has moved now to midweek. She's on Wednesdays. But on this special Labor Day show, we are going to be talking with Peter Dreyer. He is the author of a great book called The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, A Social Justice Hall of Fame. And I'll give you a little bit of a preview. I think we need to get him back on the line. Of some of the folks that he covers in this book. We're looking forward to talking about, I think, you know, some of the regular suspects, a couple of presidents, including FDR and Lyndon Johnson, but also some folks that are maybe a little bit more off the beaten trail, perhaps folks that you're familiar with, but you don't really necessarily associate them with social justice movements and social change. By way of example, Helen Keller, Dr. Seuss, Albert Einstein. So anyway, it should be a fascinating discussion. We're talking about folks, again, through the course of a century, folks both well-known, parts of movements, people who contributed in many different realms. And again, Peter Dreyer is on the phone from out in Los Angeles. Welcome to A Public Affair, and I guess we are going to try once more time to reconnect there with Peter. That's the joy of live radio. We should mention also that Peter is a longtime contributor to The Nation, and he is a professor of urban studies who's made many different contributions. So a bunch of different ways we can go with this conversation. In addition to to writing his book, The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. He's also written a book recently called The Next Los Angeles, The Struggle for a Livable City, and Place Matters, Metropolitics for the 21st Century, Regions That Work, How Cities and Suburbs Can Grow Together, and also Up Against the Sprawl, Public Policy and the Making of Southern California. We've got him on the line. Peter, hey, welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. Sorry about the technical difficulties there. Hey, I was telling the readers as we were waiting to get you, rather the listeners as we were waiting to get you on the
line. I hope they're readers soon.
I hope so too. one more time, just to punch it out here. Your book is The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame, and we were talking a little bit a few minutes ago, prior to going on the air, just about. You know, in some ways, I imagine a bit of a dilemma for you because you see the full sweep of history, and you know, while there are folks that stand out that I think we label as famous and outstanding in their ways, social movements are comprised of hundreds and thousands of ordinary heroes and heroines. So I guess as you're writing this book, how do you rationalize the famous and the not so famous?
Well, that's a great question. The point of the book is to celebrate the movements that made America a better country. The labor movement, the environmental movement, women's suffrage and women's rights, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, many other movements for social and economic justice. And in all those movements, you have a division of labor. You have the people, the troops on the ground, the people that do the voting, the people that engage in civil disobedience, the people that write letters to the editor, show up at rallies, donate money. All movements need rank-and-file participants. And then they also need people who were leaders of different kinds. And the book has three different kinds of people in it. The first are the organizers and the activists that built the movements from the ground up, people from Eugene Debs to Martin Luther King and Ella Baker, Walter Reuther, the labor leader, and people like that. The second group of people are politicians from your famous Wisconsin progressive Robert La Follette, to Franklin Roosevelt, to the current congressman John Lewis, who was a civil rights activist himself. And their job are to be allies of these movements and to help translate their ideas into public policy and push them into laws. And the third group are writers, artists, poets, musicians, playwrights, theologians, people that inspire us with their ideas, their writing, their music, their plays, that help us think about a different kind of world, give us hope, inspire us. So all those people are needed, all those kinds of people are needed to build movements, and of course you need lots of people. But I had to pick 100 people who I thought represented the best of the tradition of social justice activism in America. And, you know, I also cheated a little bit. The first chapter of the book has a list of 50 more people who I would have put in the book if I had more room. So I wanted to let people know that, you know, the 100 greatest is really representative of a much wider group of people.
Well, we'll try to cover as many of those different categories as we can today. But, yeah, it's just a fascinating not only the biographies that you write, which are very, very pithy and succinct and descriptive pictures of these people, but yeah, the decision making process itself is just fascinating. You know, as we being Labor Day, I want to come back to labor activism and the working rights movement in just a moment. But as I was telling our listeners while we were getting you back on the line, there are also some surprises. You were pointing out to me that folks that we know for various reasons, but perhaps not as leaders in social justice, and the two to come to mind are Helen Keller and Dr. Seuss.
Well, yeah. The book is people who are famous, you know, like Franklin Roosevelt and Martin Luther King and more recently Michael Moore and Barbara Ehrenreich. Then there are people that aren't famous but should be. People who are sort of unsung or invisible in our history books, but, you know, people should know about them. It's a key reason I wrote the book. And then there are people like Helen Keller and Dr. Seuss who were famous, but they're not famous for their radical politics. So Helen Keller is mostly known for being blind. And, of course, people know about her. They got through the movie The Miracle Worker, where Patty Duke played Helen Keller and Anne Bancroft played her teacher, Anne Sullivan. And the movie ends when Helen Keller is about 8 years old, and she learns how to speak and she learns how to recognize words. And that image of her is frozen in time. But in fact, Helen Keller went on to Radcliffe College, where she was very radicalized in the early part of the 20th century. She read lots of books on socialism and Marxism, partly because her teacher's husband was a radical. In her investigations of the causes of blindness, she discovered that blindness was much more likely to happen among poor people and among immigrants living in slums and living under miserable working conditions. And so she connected the disability of blindness to the larger economic and social system. And then for the rest of her life, she was an outspoken radical. She was a socialist. She campaigned for Eugene Debs when he ran for president on the Socialist Party ticket. She campaigned for Robert La Follette when he ran for president in 1924. She was a feminist and very active in the women's rights movement for women's suffrage. She refused to cross picket lines. There's a story in my book where she there's a silent movie made about her called Deliverance. And she went to the opening in New York, and the workers in the theater were on strike, and she refused to cross the picket line to go to the movie about herself. And she said, "I'd rather the movie fail than the strike fail." And so she was, you know, very principled about that. And she was very active in the movement against war. And throughout her life, and she died in the 1960s, throughout her life she was outspoken on all these issues. The organization she worked for, the American Federation for the Blind, was uncomfortable with her radical politics and the radical people she hung out with, but she was an incredible fundraiser for the philanthropy that helped raise money to do research and help support people who were blind. And so Helen Keller is one of those people who we all know her name, we've all read about her, but what we know about her is misleading. And the other person you mentioned is Dr. Seuss. His real name is Theodore Geisel. And, of course, he's the most famous children's book writer in history. And everybody knows Cat in the Hat and all the other famous stories he wrote. But what people don't know about him is that in the beginning of his career, the 1940s, he was a cartoonist for a left-wing newspaper, daily newspaper in New York, called PM, and he wrote some very singing radical cartoons against racism and anti-Semitism and corporate buffoons and against Hitler and so forth. And then when he started writing children's books, many of his political ideas find their way into his stories. So, for example, a couple of my favorites, Yertle the Turtle is really about Hitler. It's a metaphor for Hitler and bullies. It's about a turtle who tries to be king by oppressing the other turtles, and eventually the other turtles revolt. And so it's a story about, for children, about don't let people bully you. It's about unjust authority. It's about people who submit to injustice until they're ready to fight back. Another one of his books, obviously, The Lorax, is about corporate greed and the way it destroys the environment. And another one of my favorites is The Butter Battle Book, which he wrote as a stinging criticism of the Cold War and the nuclear arms race. It's about two sides of of people on two sides of a fence trying to outdo each other to build bigger and bigger weapons. And many of his other books have similar themes. So for half a century now, America's parents have been, and people all around the world have been reading Dr. Seuss books to their children and maybe not realizing that in between the lines of those incredible word plays and wonderful photographs are messages about social justice.
Well, and the far right was not oblivious to this aspect of his personality. I often tried to, at different times, tried to blacklist him or remove him from access to children. Is that right?
Actually, his politics were never, he never wore his politics on his sleeve, and he wasn't an activist in terms of being out there and putting his name and on petitions and so forth. So I don't think Helen Keller was often criticized by the right, but Dr. Seuss was not as big a target because he was not politically active. He did his speaking through his books.
Yeah. Well, you know, a fascinating aspect of the way that your book is constructed, and when you were talking about Helen Keller, you referenced this, talking about Eugene Debs, Robert La Follette, but is the kind of the interweaving of different people's lives, how they relate to one another. One of the things that you share about Helen Keller and a correspondence with Robert La Follette, I won't try to quote it directly, but essentially, you know, she's talking about public attitudes toward the handicap, kind of making the distinction between do-good charities that try to make people feel good and I guess, you know, social change, social justice-related work that understands someone with a disability as being a whole person, relates this to struggles of poverty and other social justice struggles. This strikes me as one of the common themes, someone who is drawing out of their own experience and then drawing other lessons from that. Is that a common thread in your book?
Well, a lot of the people in the book, including Helen Keller, were born to privilege. And they had to make a choice, a couple of choices. One is, what do they do for their careers? And women in particular, starting with people like Jane Addams in the late 1800s and Eleanor Roosevelt and Frances Perkins, later the Secretary of Labor, and Alice Hamilton and Florence Kelly, who were active in the Settlement House movement. They were born to privilege, but they made decisions to be active in social justice movements. Many other women and some men in their situation would have gotten involved in charity, would have gotten involved in philanthropy. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. But as you said, Helen Keller understood that charity, you know, do-gooderism, social service, often puts people in a dependent position. And her view was that people with physical disabilities, as well as people with economic and social disadvantages, they had to build from the bottom up, and they had to build movements to change their conditions rather than just accept charity. And so, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt was, in her early years, was active in the Settlement House movement and in the National Consumers League and in a group called the National Trade Union Women's Trade Union League. And these are all groups that helped to organize immigrants and workers to better their lives. So whether we're talking about working-class people like Rose Schneiderman, who was a garment worker who became a radical, a socialist, and a union organizer, whether we're talking about Helen Keller and Eleanor Roosevelt and Jane Addams, who were born to wealth but got involved in the movements for social justice, they all had to make choices about what kind of lives to lead. And the people in my book decided to live lives where they were in solidarity with working-class people and the poor.
All right. I want to come back to a more contemporary person, a good one of my favorite interview subjects of all time, Barbara Ehrenreich, and some of the insights she provided. Just a second. We actually have a caller on the line. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 608-256-2001. Caller, your comment or question for Peter Dreyer.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to point out some more points about Dr. Seuss. Some of his stories, I believe The Sneetches was one, which is a direct parody on racism and bigotry. And I believe the story about the Zacks had to do with the Cold War and the standoff between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Another thing that's interesting about Dr. Seuss is that his cartooning in the years just before and during World War II, a lot of the object of his cynicism was, of course, the isolationists and Charles Lindbergh, and his cartoons vividly depict the naivete of the isolationists, that the U.S. could be kept out of World War II indefinitely. And another point, it's not well known, but I believe the works of Helen Keller were among those that were burned by the Nazis shortly after Hitler took power in 1933. So I'll just take any additional comments off the air, and thanks for an interesting program.
Well, thanks for your insights. Any thoughts on that, Peter?
Well, you know, the caller's absolutely right. The Sneetches, which Dr. Seuss Theodore Geisler wrote in 1961, was inspired by his opposition to anti-Semitism. It exposes the what he thought of as the absurdity of racial and religious bigotry and the sneeches of these yellow bird-like creatures that have a green star on their belly. Well, that's not too far from the yellow star that Hitler, the Nazis, made the Jews wear in Germany during the days of Nazi persecution. And with regard to his cartoons, yeah, he was unrelentingly targeting some of the right-wing isolationist bigots of the 1940s. Father Coughlin, who was a radio priest out of Detroit, who was an anti-Semite and a racist, and as the caller said, Charles Lindbergh, who was an American hero for his aviator heroics, but he was also sympathetic to Hitler. He was an anti-Semite. He was not a very nice person, and he was a reactionary. And Dr. Seuss didn't spare him any tolerance at all. And so there's a great deal of anger in Dr. Seuss's cartoons about racism and anti-Semitism. But he sort of tempered that anger and corralled it in his children's books so that he comes off as a kind of lovable figure. And, you know, everybody thinks of Dr. Seuss now as this man who helped, you know, generations of children learn how to love reading and to expand their vocabularies. And that, you know, and that was mainly what he was trying to do, but he also had a social message he was trying to translate into children's, what children could understand, and to give children a sense of their own power.
Yeah.
And so he was, you know, he was one of the great figures of the 20th century that I try to profile in the book.
Well, interesting stuff. And of course, in the remaining 20 minutes, we're not going to be able to cover, even scratch the surface of everyone that you're covering here. I do want to move into kind of the area of workers' rights, labor rights, and maybe in a sort of an unconventional way. Again, as I mentioned, Barbara Ehrenreich is a contemporary writer, and you bring up that she writes much in the tradition of muckrakers like Lincoln Steffens, Upton Sinclair, Ida Tarbell of a century before. But one of the most powerful pieces that she's written is a book called Nickeled and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. And it's, I guess, parallel with Helen Keller's experience. While she may have not been quite at the same social status as Helen Keller, she certainly was living a privileged life, although her sister, she mentions, had gone from one low-wage job to another. That was an experience that was very alien to her, and yet what she says explicitly in the book is the working poor aren't an alien species, and she was very effective in talking about setting conditions for a year in which she saw firsthand exactly what working people on limited incomes, what they face in their lives. What's the significance of a contribution like that?
Well, there's always been people who expose injustice through their writings and hold a mirror up to society and say, is this the kind of society we really want to be? Barbara Ehrenreich actually grew up in Montana, and her family came out of copper miners. And so she did have a working class background. She went on to get a PhD in biology before she became active in the healthcare rights movement, and then became probably one of the most famous feminist writers. But when she decided to write Nickeled and Dimed and spent a year working in working-class jobs, she worked at Walmart, she worked as a house cleaner, she worked as a waitress, she was doing it, in, as you said, in the tradition of many other people who did similar kinds of exposés. Upton Sinclair, who wrote, you know, 50 books in his lifetime, went to Chicago and wrote a novel, The Jungle, about the miserable conditions in the meatpacking industry in the early 1900s. And it's so outraged, when the novel came out in 1906, it so outraged the American public about the quality of the food they were eating and the conditions under which the food, the meat they were eating, was made, that inspired activists and President Theodore Roosevelt to pass the Meat Inspection Act, and then later the Food and Drug Act. And Lincoln Steffens exposed corruption in our big cities. Another person in my book is Lewis Hine, who was a photographer at the turn of the century who took photographs, very realistic photographs, of children working in mines and mills and factories and sweatshops. And his photographs helped to trigger the movement against child labor. Other people wrote stories about the conditions in the sweatshops for an organization called the National Consumer League. That's how Frances Perkins, so later the Secretary of Labor, got her start as an activist with the National Consumer League. And so Barbara Ehrenreich is in this long tradition of muckrakers and social realists, writers and photographers and painters and others who expose the miserable conditions of life for ordinary people and for the poor and for children, and then trigger the moral compass of America. They appeal to our conscience. Michael Harrington did the same thing in 1962 with his book, The Other America, which held a mirror up to the country and said, do you know that about a third of the people in the country are living in poverty, something that most Americans weren't aware of at the time. So Barbara's in this tradition of people who use their skills to expose injustice. And, you know, Michael Moore has done the same thing in his film. So it's part of a wonderful tradition of American writing and filmmaking and photography.
You know, as we're talking, it's reminding me of a topic that came up in a recent show where we were talking about the Titanic. And even though that probably has been hyperbolized to death and other things, I mean, the aspect of our guest was especially interested in is this kind of 100-year resonance between 2012 and 1912 in terms of social movements coming into their own and standing up to that 1% that were kind of elitist and controlling things and calling the shots and folks saying that we need to change that. Again, themes resonant with the Republican convention of last week, the Democratic convention coming up. Do you sense that, especially having explored these folks, you know, newly in this book, that there is something that we're now coming full circle on? Many of the same struggles of 100 years ago are coming back to us, and there are new folks arising in different ways to advance social justice in the face of those threats.
Every generation has to find its own niche for fighting for social justice, and some of the issues remain. There's always economic inequality. There's always some kind of discrimination, but we have to temper that with the particulars of each era. So, just last week, California, the state legislature passed a law called the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, and that is part of a movement of domestic workers' rights, of dandies and housekeepers and other domestic workers who've been shut out of the labor laws for the last 50 years, 60 years. There's a woman that lives in New York named Ai-Jen Poo, a community organizer who started the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and they passed a similar law in New York 2 years ago. And so, you know, that movement has been gaining ground. A movement in Florida called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is kind of led by a guy named Lucas Benitez, who's kind of the Cesar Chavez of the 21st century, trying to improve working conditions for the tomato pickers. That if you like ketchup or tomatoes, the odds are pretty good that one of those Florida tomato pickers pick those tomatoes, and they live under slave-like conditions. And thanks to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, they've doubled their wages, improved the health and safety conditions of their workplaces, often in coalitions with consumer groups, college students, and religious and church organizations. Obviously, Occupy Wall Street is in that tradition of challenging the power of the economic elite, and as is the battles in Wisconsin over the last year and a half. And I think part of the lesson of my book is that, as Michael Harrington said, if you're going to be a social justice activist in America, you have to be a long-distance runner. You can't be a sprinter, because there are always setbacks and defeats. So the election in Wisconsin failed to overturn Scott Walker's governorship. That's a setback, but you know that's always been the case. If you look over the long arc of the last 100 years, and you think about things that were once considered radical, the minimum wage, Social Security, laws protecting the environment and consumers, women's suffrage and women's equality, and more recently, gay and lesbian rights. These are all ideas that were once on the margins, once considered fringe, radical, socialist, utopian ideas. And now they're all things we take for granted. And so I think if we look at the long arc of history, the movements that I discuss in the book and that are still going on are movements that that changed what we take for granted. Social Security was first introduced in Congress by Victor Berger, the socialist congressman from Milwaukee. And it wasn't another 25 years until during the Depression and the New Deal when Congress passed and Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act. And the women's suffrage movement took many years before women got the right to vote. And the civil rights, the NAACP was founded in 1909. They made, some significant strides during the first half of the 20th century, but it really wasn't until the 1950s and 60s that the civil rights movement was able to change the Jim Crow laws in the South and change our consciousness about racism in America and so forth. And so I think that the movements that are happening now, yeah. Occupy and the movements for workers' rights and for civil rights and gay rights and the expansion of farm workers' rights and domestic workers' rights, these are all an extension of those struggles of the previous century. And Pete Seeger has this great line in one of his songs, "It's always darkest before the dawn." You really never know, where history is going to take us. But the people in the book were people that didn't wait for the time to be ripe. As I say in the book, they ripened the time. They made the changes that had to be made. They yeah. fought the fights before they were popular. And there are still, tens of thousands of people all over the country today that are doing the same thing.
Yeah, just to amplify, in the days following the recall election, that was one of the, I think, the pieces of solace I could give to some of my younger friends is to look at that greater arc of history, that notion of bending toward justice, and then the gay rights movement as a gay man. Boy, the changes we've seen in the last couple of decades. Again, we've got Peter Dreyer on the line. He is the author of a great new book called The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. 608-256-2001 is the number to call if you'd like to join in the conversation. And believe we do have another caller. Your comment or question, please.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes. Peter Dreyer?
Yes.
I believe your book is accurate. And the 100 greatest Americans in the last century.
Sir, if you could turn your radio down to the background, I'm getting a little
bit. A solid book honoring Euro, Afro, and Asian Americans. There are no red Americans. I'm not blaming you, cousin. We all got sabotaged. But the red people were here first, indigenous. It's not the Bible. With the Lakota, they came out of the wind cave 1 million years ago. And all this information is not out there. So I'm sure your book is great, but I'm just saying the red people, again, get the back of the bus.
All right, let's give Peter a chance to respond to that. Thank you for your call.
Well, one of the great things that happened beginning in the 60s and 70s was the American historians began to rethink how we teach our history. And so, when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s, Native American history was, not really part of the study of American history at all, except, people playing cowboys and Indians. And the same thing is true of slaves, and the same thing is true of women's issues and women in our history. So, the caller is right that for many years, Native Americans and others weren't given their due in their struggles for justice, and that's why Howard Zinn wrote the People's History of the United States and probably helped to remedy that. And the whole teaching of history in the United States has changed a bit, but not enough. you know, my students at Occidental College are very bright. They went to, you know, they went to good high schools, or they were in the top of their classes in whatever high schools they went to. And they don't know their own history. A lot of our Latino students and African-American students don't know their history. Most of the African-American students in my classes and all the other students, they've never heard of Paul Robeson, for example. And in fact, most of the people in my book, they probably wouldn't have heard of, or if they heard about them, they just knew their name. They don't know anything about them. So, you know, it's not just Native Americans. There's lots of other groups of people and kinds of people in the country who need their voices to be heard. And I had room for 100 people in the book. And you know, one of the great things I like about the book is that it is triggering the kind of debate and controversy about who belongs in the book. The book started as a cover story in The Nation 2 years ago. Back then, I wrote a piece called The 50 Most Influential Progressives of the 20th Century. And it got thousands and thousands of responses on The Nation website and emails. And there were two kinds of responses: how dare you put this person in, and how dare you keep this person out. And, you know, so when I decided to expand that article into a much longer book, you know, I was hoping that it would get people talking about who deserves to be recognized as a great American and the movements that they represented. So I'm glad the caller is willing to debate who should be and who should not be in the book.
Well, I think you've answered the caller's concerns in some ways, although, you know, the absence of having a Native American representation in the book, of course, is emblematic of a larger invisibility of Native American people and the way the mainstream media has not covered stories that ought to get all kinds of attention and other things. Having recently taken a class on exactly that subject, I agree. But no, I appreciate your putting that in the larger perspective. Hey, one other category I guess I wanted to cover with you a little bit. You do talk about a whole range of folks who were involved with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Two I wanted to pick out of that are James Lawson, who is a pastor who's visited here recently in Madison, who in many people attribute this to bringing some of the nonviolent techniques to the Black Civil Rights Movement. And then John Lewis, of course, contemporary congressperson, as you had mentioned earlier, I think was among those that he trained. Is that right?
Yes. James Lawson was a Methodist minister who moved to India as a missionary back in the 1950s after he went to college. African-American man. Grew up in a home where a very religious home. And many of the people in my book come out of religious backgrounds.
And as I shared with you, my mother was part of the group that went over to India with him. So special interest.
Yeah,
there.
Well, and while he was, and he went to India to study Gandhiism and nonviolence. And that's what he was doing when the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 broke out. And he was the same age as Martin Luther King, and he quickly came back to the United States and jumped into the civil rights movement, became very friendly with Martin Luther King and with pacifists. He became active in a group called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is one of those small little organizations that's had a huge impact in our country. There's lots of groups like that. The Highlander School is another one. And so he was asked by Martin Luther King to come to the South. He grew up in Ohio, so to come down to the South and to participate in the civil rights movement and to be kind of the trainer, the mentor of young activists for civil rights. And so while he was initially in Nashville, Tennessee, while a student at Vanderbilt, he trained many of the high school and college students in both the black and the white universities in Nashville about civil rights, civil disobedience, nonviolence, and to inculcate in them a very deep spiritual sense of why one should go about pursuing social change through nonviolence. And one of those people was a young student at Fisk College, African-American college, named John Lewis, who had grown up in in rural.
Peter, I apologize. We're down to just our last 2 minutes, so I want to just focus in on something relative to John Lewis. By the way, I also mentioned that a lot of Jim Lawson's current activism is now in LGBT rights, inclusion within the church and other contexts. Interesting, yeah. Coming full circle. With John Lewis, in about a minute and a half to go here, if you could, one of the things that John Lewis does is he takes delegations of congresspeople down to Selma, talks about the voting rights era, talks about the resonance of history with the here and now. Do you have any thoughts about why that's an important mission?
Well, you know, somebody once said, if we don't learn our history, then we repeat it. And so John Lewis, who risked his life many times during the Civil Rights Movement, he was a freedom rider and on the buses, and he got his head bashed in many times. You know, he really paid his dues, and now he's a congressman. But he's always been, like many of the people in the book, once they get into elected office, they remain organizers and activists. And so what he's trying to do is to remind his colleagues in Congress and remind the media and the public that the struggles of the Civil Rights Movement led to many improvements in our society, but there's much more to change in the future. And if we don't learn from the mistakes of the past as well as the successes of the past, then we won't realize how we stand on the shoulders of the movements that brought us a much better society today. And so taking people to Selma, helping to organize the immigrant workers' rights freedom ride that he helped to do a couple years ago, connecting today's immigrant rights movement with yesterday's civil rights movement, these are all part of his mission to keep the flame of the civil rights movement lit. And I admire him a great deal.